If you've ever been to Chicago or Milwaukee and stood at the edge of Lake Michigan, trying to convince yourself that that huge body of water is in fact a lake and not an ocean, then you'll know what is meant by the Fresh Coast, this area of North America around the Great Lakes. And this Fresh Coast is something that Kevin Schaefer, Executive Director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, MMSD, is very protective of. In fact, I even have a t-shirt kindly gifted to me by one of his colleagues at MMSD that says Fresh Coast Guardian. But what does it mean to be a Fresh Coast Guardian? That's what we'll be delving into in this episode. How he is working to protect those Fresh Coast water bodies, as well as those Fresh Coast inhabitants, from floods in a world of increasing climate extremes. We'll be talking about having a watershed approach, nature-based solutions, and pickle barrels. I'm Tallulah Lutkin, and this is the Water Leaders Pod, unfiltered access to water's leading voices.
Where are you at, Tallulah?
The office is in Oxford, and I live in London. I don't know if you follow soccer or football at all, but I live next to the Arsenal football stadium, that's where I'm based. Thanks so much for being a podcast. First question to all of our guests is, how is the weather where you are?
You know, today is beautiful. We're going to get up to about 60 degrees and sunny. Tomorrow we got rain coming, but it's been a very nice spring.
That is incredibly lucky, because it is grey and raining and pelting it down where I am. So it's nice to hear that some people are getting the good weather. And so just can you tell me a little bit about your utility, about its responsibilities, and about the Fresh Coast as well? Because I knew about the East Coast, the West Coast, but before I got my special t-shirt, I didn't know about the Fresh Coast. Can you just tell me a bit about that, please?
Well, first, just thank you for having me on this podcast. It's going to be fun. Milwaukee, Wisconsin sits on the Great Lakes, so we were right on the coast of the Great Lakes. And as you said, there's the East Coast, which is the New York Atlantic Ocean area, and the West Coast, which is the Pacific. But we like to call ourselves the Fresh Coast because we are sitting on one of the largest Fresh Coast water bodies in the world. And we take great pride in that. We have t-shirts, as you're wearing, advertise it. But, you know, this is the drinking water supply for millions of people in Canada and in the United States. And so we take great responsibility to try to protect that water body from pollution. As I said, Milwaukee is in the state of Wisconsin on the Great Lakes. I run a utility, which is the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District, which we service about 1.1 million people in 28 different municipalities. And we do both flood management and wastewater treatment. We do not do drinking water. So we have multiple jurisdictional responsibilities. And, you know, those can deal from trying to prevent combined sewer overflows and separate sewer overflows to trying to prevent flooding in people's homes and basements. It's a huge responsibility that I've got roughly 240 people that are doing just a great job to address all those issues.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of responsibility. See, I just heard you mention combined sewer overflow and separate sewer overflow. So I thought that you had more of combined on the east and separate on the west. But so you guys have both on the Fresh Coast?
Yeah, there's roughly 700 communities in the United States that have combined sewer systems. In Milwaukee, Chicago, the older communities have combined systems. In my area in Milwaukee, about 23% of my service area is a combined sewer area. The rest of it's a separate sewer area, which just reflects the development of the area. We started out as combined sewers, and then as we expanded our footprint and our land mass for the region, we moved to a separate sewer system.
Okay, yeah, so a little bit of both. I imagine that's quite challenging to manage both of those systems.
It is, and we installed a deep tunnel system back in 1993, the first deep tunnel.
I was born in 1993, so that's...
There you go. Oh, man, do I feel old. No, it's fine. Yeah, no, we installed the first deep tunnel in 1993, and it was a result of the Clean Water Act passing in the United States in 1972. So there was lawsuits and other legal regulatory steps to get to that point. But that tunnel came online in August of 1993, and we immediately saw a benefit where before we were averaging 50 to 60 combined sewer overflows per year, we dropped that to about 2. So it's been a great feature of our infrastructure plan. We're looking at an entire watershed approach, but that's really the foundation for all we do. And since I've been here, I started in 1998 at the district. Since so I guess you were 5 when I started at the district.
yep.
In 1998, we have since then built 2 additional tunnel segments on that original tunnel. And right now we have 521 million gallons of storage in the tunnel. And then we have 2 water reclamation facilities, wastewater treatment facilities, that on a normal day, they're treating 65 to 70 million gallons a day. And on a wet day, they can go up to 300 or 330 million gallons a day. So as any utility in the country, when it rains, as we're going to have tomorrow, and as you're having today, it really ramps up quickly. And you have to be able to handle those peak flows when they come to you. And that's where the deep tunnel comes in.
Right. So the deep tunnel, I guess, is gray infrastructure, right? Just a big tunnel that you've installed. So is that the sort of primary approach, or, you know, so you're looking at other things? Like, I heard you guys are looking into nature-based solutions as well.
Yeah, I think of the tunnel as the foundational approach. That was the first thing. It really dropped the overflows, as I said. But we have a goal to have 100% capture. So we want 0 separate sewer overflows and 0 combined sewer overflows. And I know that's a lofty goal, but I'm not going to strive to not be perfect if I can. So we have a goal for 100%. And what we're trying to do, since we've expanded the tunnel and used the tunnel, of course, we're always upgrading the treatment plants because we have to treat that water at some point if it gets into the tunnels. So we have to make sure that all the treatment facilities are working. But to really manage the water when it rains very hard, we look at a watershed. So we're trying to manage both the stormwater and the wastewater and floodwater at the same time. And to do that, we're trying to hold water on the surface in green infrastructure or natural nature-based infrastructure so it does not get down into the pipes, into the gray infrastructure. And we installed over 140 million gallons of green infrastructure in the region. And this is 140 million gallons every time it rains. It's not an annual number. So every time it rains, we can capture 140 million gallons of rainwater.
Okay. So yeah, and then it kind of filters down into the tunnel, and then you can treat it. So you mentioned watershed. I know that this is something that you have, like you said, watershed approach. But what is a watershed?
Well, when we were in grade school, we talked about it. But watersheds are really... it's like a funnel. So at the rim of the funnel is the headwaters or the edges of that watershed. So at any point in a watershed, the water flows downstream to a single water body, a river, a creek, whatever, and then flows downstream. But if you think of a funnel as a watershed as a funnel, that really takes all the water in that watershed and conveys it downstream to a single point. And so we're trying to manage all that water on the rim of that funnel. We're trying to manage the water that gets into the tunnel at the downstream end. We're also doing a lot of flood management work where we're removing concrete line channels and trying to provide 100-year protection to the residents of the region by installing natural infrastructure in those areas. So it's really a large-scale, nature-based approach to flood management. But we're doing both that large-scale, nature-based approach with flood management, but we're also installing smaller-scale, nature-based solutions like green roofs, porous pavement, bioswales, rain gardens, rain barrels. And it's been quite a journey. We've been doing the green infrastructure for about 20 years. And we've been doing flood management for that same time period. And we've really seen the public respond well to this.
That's great. Yeah, I think that something that I've heard is that you really tried to get the public on side. And something that I read is that you encourage people to use pickle barrels to collect rain when it rains. Is that true?
Yep. That was our original program. That was the first one we started with because it was something that people could see, feel, touch. You know, it was something they could understand. So we started collecting pickle barrels, and there's other type of uses for these barrels, but pickle barrels, which is a 55-gallon drum, basically. And we convert those to store water at the downspout of a home or a business. So at the point where that pipe comes off the roof, if we can store 55 gallons in that barrel, that 55 gallons then is delayed going downstream and causing flooding or stormwater issues. So we're doing everything large and small to try to address the trying to get to that 100%.
I also read that something that felt a little bit counterintuitive, but now I think I'm understanding it with this analogy of basically preventing everything from getting to the tunnel, is that you are looking to encourage people to use less water when it rains. So, you know, for me, when you think about collecting water in a barrel or using less water anyway, those sound like drought measures, not excess water measures. So yeah, can you just say a bit more about that, about how it works, kind of like preventing people from using water when it rains?
Sure. Yeah, and we have both here. We have very large storms, and then we have drought conditions as well. So we're kind of dealing with that as the climate's changing. But when we see a forecast of over an inch and a half of rainfall coming to the area, we will put out what we call a water drop alert. And it people sign up for it. If they have a cell phone, they'll that phone will beep at them when we put this alert out. And it asks them to delay that load of laundry, that dishwasher usage, you know, just trying to think about the water that they use in the house or at the business. And, you know, it helps. It's not the cure-all for everything as far as water volume, but it's a great way to bring the public into the discussion about how they can help prevent overflows, reduce pollution getting into rivers.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That's interesting. You said that you guys get droughts and excess rain. So as you mentioned, you've been in the job for 25 years. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm assuming that you must have noticed the impacts of climate change and how has that affected how you protect, you know, how you carry out your job and how you protect this watershed?
Yeah, we've really seen a change in the rainfall pattern since around 2000. So for the last 20, 25 years, we've seen a change in the rainfall patterns where we're seeing very intense storms hit, you know, lots of volume of water coming down onto the land surface. We'll take that storm, and then we'll have a drought period after that, and then we'll have another heavy rainstorm. So it seems to go in peaks and valleys. And we really see that impact on our flood management work because that's, you know, it's on the surface. People see it. They see the water flowing by. And so what we're trying to do is manage for that future or actually current case of changing climate. And we're building facilities to address some of those larger storms that we're anticipating. It's tough because we don't know exactly what that larger storm is, but we're taking a conservative approach to what we do to try to make sure that we do it at least what we can to minimize the negative impacts of either the storm. On the drought side, it's a little different. Most people think with a wastewater treatment plant or flood management utility, you like droughts. But we've had droughts where it causes a lot of problems with the treatment process at the plants. It causes septic system, or septic inflows to come into the treatment system. So you have to really manage that different type of wastewater flow when it is a drought period.
Yeah, I spoke to Adel Hashkavil from California, and what you're describing, he describes it as climate whiplash, this kind of idea of you go from a extreme drought to rain and you kind of don't know where you stand. But from your perspective, it's more the excess of water that's an issue, though.
That's really the problem here. Adel, he's a great friend. LA's probably has more of the drought conditions on their side, although lately they've had a lot of rain. For us, it's really the floods, the peak flows that we're worried about. And when you sit on a large water body like we do with Lake Michigan, the Great Lakes, as the storms pass over, what we found is that because the lakes are in the summer, the lakes are cooler, and that change in temperature as the storms come along, they will just drop a huge amount of water before they hit that cooler area. So that temperature change that we're seeing from climate change is impacting us as well. And that's another reason to do nature-based or green infrastructure, because in an urban setting, we're seeing that urban heat island impact, and this green infrastructure in these very impervious areas will help us eventually to lower that temperature, we hope.
Yeah, that's right, because I think that's what's really interesting about nature-based solutions is that they're seen at face value as a climate adaptation measure, in the sense that obviously they help with the flooding, but they're also a climate mitigation measure, because they also, like you say, they reduce the urban heat island effect, and they actually can maybe help have less extreme storms in the future. Have you sort of seen this? Is this something that you've seen, or is it too far in the,
you know, it's further in the future? It's too far in the future, but we do have the University of Wisconsin doing some analysis on this, and they have started to see that there is an impact from nature-based solutions. We've not seen a number yet, but they're saying there's a benefit to doing this in the long term. And it's, you know, it's just, when we started this, it wasn't for climate adaptation or mitigation. We were sitting there thinking, we got to try to manage this drop of water on the surface. We got to keep it out of the tunnel, keep it out of the river so we don't flood. But as we've matured on our climate journey, we've seen that these steps will really help in other ways, as you were talking about, Tallulah, with managing climate and mitigating climate change as we move forward. Another project that we have, which is a larger scale green infrastructure project, is called Green Seams. And Green Seams is a land acquisition program where in the upper reaches of the watershed, it's more of a rural setting. And so we're trying to acquire land voluntarily up in those areas to prevent it from being developed with concrete or asphalt or any type of impervious cover. And we started that program because of our flood management team or our jurisdiction. But as that program has matured, we've got over 5,400 acres of land now. As that program has matured, we've realized that that is a huge mitigator for climate change. And so we're planting trees, we're restoring native vegetation, we're restoring wetlands so that they'll absorb that water for flood management issues. But as you said, there's just so many multiple benefits to this nature-based solutions that it's a win-win for everyone.
Yeah, it's always good when you can find a win-win solution. It's not easy in the water industry to find those.
No, and usually they're very expensive. And this sometimes is, but you know, you can do this work for not so much of an investment.
Yeah, that's good to know. So these land acquisitions that you're describing, those are on the sort of rim of the funnel that you were talking about. So what would you say that's the most critical area that you're focusing on? Is it on the rim, or is it at the bottleneck? Like where's the most important place?
Well, I think you have to look at the entire funnel or the entire watershed. Modeling data that shows us in the urban setting, it tells us where the critical points are that we should install the nature-based solutions in the urban impervious area. So we can target those areas. We also want to try to target some of these, make our green infrastructure equitable. Some of the areas that are lower income or disadvantaged, we see that they are experiencing some of the largest flooding issues, the most basement backup issues. So we're trying to concentrate that work in those areas as well. Again, you know, we're a wastewater flood management utility, but we're really a social utility. We're really trying to improve the lives of everyone here. So it's not, there's different reasons to do different projects, and green infrastructure helps with stormwater. It helps bring habitat back to an urban setting. It helps bring a natural setting to a very urban core area. And that improves quality of life for the residents there. The Green Seams program is, as you said, it's probably more up in the funnel part of the, or in the rim of the funnel for the watershed. But that water flows downstream. And so we have to manage it really on that entire scale.
So win-win-win. It's all these different things that it's all improving. It's great to hear. But I'm glad that you mentioned the community, because that was going to be one of my kind of focuses, is that I think that it's very important for you to be part of the community. And so, yeah, how important is it for you to demonstrate that the utility is sort of a key, you know, anchor institution really in your community? And how have you been doing that?
I am so glad you brought up anchor institutions.
I've done my research.
Every utility in the country and the world is an anchor institute. You're basically going to be here, you know, 100 years from now in some form. And so you are an anchor for that community and trying to improve the lives of the people here. It's critically important for people to see that, feel that, understand that, because, you know, you're working for them and you're working for their property values, for their public health, for their reasons to live in these communities. And so you really want to make sure that they understand the value that you're bringing to them and to the region. And you need to address it in multiple facets. It can't be just, you know, we're just treating wastewater, that's all we do. You have to really look at how you impact a neighborhood, how you can improve that neighborhood with your projects. and how you can really foster economic development, better health, you know, all of these things that everyone wants.
And I don't want to say that there are benefits to climate change because I'm going to get cancelled, but is it something that with climate change that you're seeing these bigger impacts and these floods, and that is maybe, you know, heightening the utility's profile in a way because people are kind of seeing the benefit of it a little bit more, whereas before you may have been taken for granted?
Yeah, there's been a learning curve, I think, throughout the world on climate change. You know, we still have some deniers here in the Milwaukee area. But I do think as people see the storms that are hitting us, the storms that hit other areas of the world, the forest fires, the droughts, everything that everyone are seeing, they're starting to understand that this is a real issue that needs to be addressed. So I do think that that has helped the discussion for us to really drive home the point that you have an individual impact that you can help with. So I do think it has helped us focus the discussion on water. And, you know, I've heard water be as the resource. That's the canary in the coal mine for climate change. I've heard someone say that. And it's true. I mean, when you talk about climate change, the first thing you think about is flooding or drought or you know, just all the issues with water that we face.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I've said that to so many people. I think that our publisher, Christopher, talks about it being, 70 or 80% of climate change is water. And you're right. When you ask people, you know, so it's floods and drought, and then how do we manage that? And I don't know, is climate change, is so you're talking about having this goal of 0% sewer overflows. Is climate change going to, you know, are you kind of, is it making a difference? Or is it going to make it harder to achieve that goal?
Yeah, I think of us as a hamster in a wheel. I mean, we're running as fast as we can on that wheel, but it just keeps turning, and that it turns faster with climate change. We are on, you're really trying to address these issues as fast as we can. The climate's changing just as fast right now. So we need to continue, you know, every year, every minute, pushing forward on these initiatives. But it's it makes the job harder.
Yeah, I can imagine. And something else that we hear a lot about and that I'm just imagining is making your job harder is micropollutants. Is that something that is a big, I'm imagining it's something that's a big issue for you, PFAS and all these other things. And yeah, how are you managing it? What's your approach to tackling that?
Yeah, we've got pharmaceuticals, we've got microplastics, we've got PFAS. All of these issues are things that everyone in the world is facing right now. Fortunately, you know, knock on wood, fortunately for PFAS, we've only got some small areas that we've found high levels of PFAS, and we've not really found it in our wastewater to a high extent.
That's pretty lucky.
It is. We're still waiting. You know, EPA has not really come down with any guidelines or metrics for PFAS for wastewater, so we're still waiting to see on that. But we... I didn't talk about this earlier, but we take our biosolids that we produce at our wastewater plants. And since 1926, we've produced a fertilizer called Milorganite, Milwaukee wow. Organic Nitrogen.
Sorry, did you say 1926?
1926. I wasn't wow. born then. I was not around.
I don't think my grandma was born back then. Wow, that's incredible.
1926, they started making a fertilizer. It's a heat-dried product out of our biosolids, and we bag it now. We sell it in the open commercial market here in the United States and Canada, and you know, we make around $11 million a year selling our biosolids. But when you bringing that back to the PFAS issue, we've got 50 states that we'd like to sell that in. And right now we're selling Milorganite in 49 states in the United States. And there's very strict limits on PFAS in the biosolids product itself. And we're able to meet those criteria right now. So we feel pretty good about PFAS. But you've got microplastics out there. We need to deal with those in some fashion. Just plastics in general, we need to deal with in some fashion. And then pharmaceuticals. And that, you know, we're doing research with the university here to really determine if there's treatment processes that we can do, or if we need to have better medicine collection programs, which we have one now. But do we need to expand that to try to keep them out of the system altogether as much as we can?
Yeah, in the same way that you're trying to prevent water from getting into the system too much, if you prevent the pollutants from getting the system in the first place. I guess that helps.
Yep.
Yeah, good to know. So, we've touched on a few things about climate change, all these challenges, but at the end of the day, how optimistic are you about, you know, the water sector in general, about what you're going to be doing for your utility?
You know, I'm really optimistic. You look at where we were when the Clean Water Act passed in 1972 to where we are today. The water, wastewater utilities in the country and in the world have done so much. And in the United States, I really focus on because of the Clean Water Act. But we've seen a 180-degree turnaround on the treatment and the improvement in the environment that we've seen. And I think as climate change becomes more understood, we're up for the challenge. We can make that same 180 leap to address some of the climate change initiatives that will help the region. When you treat wastewater or drinking water, you use immense amounts of energy. So if we can reduce our energy by becoming more efficient, our energy use by becoming more efficient, and if we can convert to renewable energy, which we have a goal for that as well, you know, all these measures will build up to a point where we'll be doing as much as we can in Milwaukee. And I think other utilities around the country and around the world will be doing the same thing. So I'm really optimistic. I think, you know, we are set to go. And sometimes it'll take money. Sometimes it'll take people to understand why we're doing it and what we're doing it. It'll continue to take that outreach that we're doing with the community to make sure that they understand what we do, why we do it, when we do it. But I'm optimistic. I think we have one of the best industries in the world. And as we said, water is the coal mine or the canary in the coal mine. So let's address it and move it forward.
Okay, I'm going to ask you like two more questions because you were talking about the things that you were doing with sort of climate and energy. Are you guys looking into producing biogas? Because you said you produce biosolids, but is biogas something that you're looking to?
We've been producing biogas since 1965.
Oh, so well, there you go.
We have digesters at our South Shore Water Reclamation Facility.
Wow.
And we have a dashboard that I look at every morning. And right now, year to date, so just in 2024, we're at about 50% of our energy production is from biogas. By the end of the year, that'll be closer to 80%. It always peaks as we go longer into the year. And in 2009, I wrote a document that I called a 2035 vision. And in that vision, we have the left side, the left side of my brain, which is the integrated watershed management, which is the zero CSOs, zero SSOs. But on the right side is to be 100% renewable energy, with 80% of that being self-produced.
Wow.
So we have digesters at South Shore. We produce electricity from that. We just last month passed a new energy plan for the year 2035. And that calls for us to expand those digesters and expand the storage vessels to store the gas in to burn in the generators. And then we're going to build a 19-mile pipeline that connects our two water reclamation facilities so that as we produce the gas and the energy at the one South Shore plant, we can ship it up to the Jones Island plant and use it there as well.
That's incredible.
We also have turbines that burn landfill gas. So as landfill waste decomposes, it produces methane. We've got a 25-year contract that we're in about year 9 on right now with a landfill. And they capture and clean that gas and pump it down to our Jones Island plant. We burn that in turbines. And we use the electricity from the turbines to run Jones Island on and the waste heat from those turbines to dry our malorganite.
Wow, that's incredible. So it's like you've got a water watershed, but you also got an energy shed. I mean, it sounds like you've got energy coming from all over the place.
That is a great analogy. Really is an energy shed as well.
You can have that one for free.
Okay, thank you. I better write that one down.
So one last question. I mean, you said, you've got 25 years of experience at the head of this utility, and I don't know how many other years of experience in water in general, but if you could say something to the water community, or even to people who don't really know anything about water, what would you say? What would you tell them?
Don't limit yourselves. I think that a lot of times, either in the industry or just, you know, in what we do, we look at what we have to do and not what we want to do. And for the industry, we'll say, well, we have to meet permits, so that's all we're going to do. I really think we have to start thinking more along the watershed, along the approach that we are a social institute as well, that we need to help people. And so we really need to not limit ourselves to just treating wastewater or managing flooding. We need to concentrate on making people's lives better and doing what we can to do that. And that may not be something that we do ourselves, but it may be something that we partner with others to do. And I think that's probably the most critical piece.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Thanks so much, Kevin. That's really inspiring. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks so much to Kevin and MMSD. If you want to learn more about the world of water, you can check out all of our coverage at www.globalwaterintel.com. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the Water Leaders Pod on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts to get access to new episodes as soon as they drop. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating. Next time, we'll be hearing from Rock Sharoo, CEO of Sydney Water, about his big plans for investing in Sydney's water infrastructure. This episode was produced by Sam Dennis, and our music was composed by DeCoco. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.